Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. Throughout this series, created in partnership with Coutts, I will be speaking to senior experts, thought leaders, and influencers from the worlds of travel, architecture, investment, consumer goods, and more, as we examine how we can embed purpose and sustainability into our everyday lives. From responsible investment to electric vehicles to eco-conservation, we will explore the new technology, partnerships, and initiatives helping us all to lead cleaner and greener lives. My guest today is Mo Sayed, Head of Asset Management at Coutts. Mo and his team help their clients make educated and impactful decisions about their investment portfolios, comprising over 30 billion pounds of assets under management. Mo is a member of the Corporate Advisory Board for the British Academy's project on the future of the corporation. Supported by partners including Coutts, this major research and public engagement program aims to contribute to a paradigm shift that redefines business for the 21st century. Mo has been instrumental in developing Coutts' strategic plan around purpose. He's passionate about responsible investment, helping to drive the climate agenda for the wider NatWest Group. Before joining Coutts, Mo spent 2 decades working in investment banking in a number of senior executive roles. Welcome, Mo.
Thank you very much, Paul, and a real pleasure to be here. Fantastic to be part of this series, real privilege. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And you have a wealth of experience, so perfectly suited to answer, I guess, the kind of first high-level question which I'd like to put you, which is, what does it really mean to invest with purpose?
Good question, Paul. I think if you look at purpose in this broader sense, and that's purpose with a capital P, you start to sort of get to the nub of what is it that you want and what is it that your expected outcomes are. And I'll take a couple of steps back from asset management and talk about purpose in the broader sense. So what is purpose? You know, to me, many years ago, I spent almost a decade in Japan, and I came across something called Ikigai. And that's, you know, a term that in Japan is prevalent, and particularly it originates from a particular island called Okinawa, which has the longest life expectancy rates in the world. And what does it mean? It essentially means, what's your reason to jump out of bed every morning? What's that purpose? And very quickly, as I got to the understanding of their culture, then that particular word, you know, it started to make, you know, a lot of sense around what is it that defines each one of us and what is our purpose in the broader society, our role in the company and the company's role in the society as well. And that basically became a lot of my foundation for a lot of my thinking around not just, you know, how I live or how we live, but also how I bring that into the work. And therefore, if I can just very quickly describe what it means, it's 4 primary elements which define each one of us, but also society as a whole. What do you love? That's your passion. What the world needs? That's your mission. What are you good at? That's your vocation. And what do you get paid for? And that's your profession. And the intersection of the 4 and the overlapping concentric circles basically then drives that purpose. And so when it came to asset management, bringing it back to where we started, it's, you know, what is the intended consequence of wealth? And that's something that we use with our clients in Coutts a fair bit, which is, what are the consequences that, you know, you have as a wealthy individual in terms of what you want the wealth to do, both in terms of the legacy you might want to leave, you know, for your family, your children, or for society as a whole, but also what impact do you want it to have? And so as you start to bring some of those in, you very rapidly start to formulate, you know, what I call something around responsibility, that each one of us has a responsibility for how we live our day-to-day lives. And of course, you know, from a wealth perspective, that wealth overlay gives it even more perspective, which is then what's the purpose of that wealth? So you've created this wealth, you worked very hard. So what do you want it to do? Because at a certain level, you start to then look at, okay, what legacy might I want to leave, and so on.
So there was a time in the world where the philosophy that you've just articulated would be compatible with a make your money in one bucket and maximize your profits in one bucket. And then if you want to lead a life of purpose, give that money away philanthropically in line with your value. And there's been a really important shift, I would say, and that you're at the heart of, where that dichotomy is no longer applicable. That in fact, how people make their money and how they allocate their assets is being done with purpose. And so I'd like to ask you, as a person who's in a very important bank and a very important position in such a bank, how are you able to persuade both yourself and your very important clients that by responsibly investing, they are actually also going to maximize their returns?
Yeah. So I think what's the role that we play as what I call a trusted partner and also an indispensable partner for our clients? The role is, you know, multifaceted. One of those, for people that have created wealth and then trust us when managing their wealth, is to preserve the wealth. They've already taken considerable risks to create the wealth that they have. And so what they don't want to do is delegate that risk management and the management of wealth to someone that may take undue risk with, you know, what they've achieved. So our core philosophy of investment is preservation. The second is around, you know, the growth of that capital. So preservation and consistency being first and foremost, and then growth being second. That then comes down to individual circumstances around the conversation that we will have. You know, is it for the next 20, 30 years? Is it over a generation, or is it over several generations? And of course, time frames start to change both risk profiling, but also the intended consequences of where they want to be. So many of our clients will set up philanthropic trusts. They'll set up trusts that then give some of the money to the next generation, but some other money to have some other impact. So we will be fulfilling that role holistically for each one of our clients and saying which bucket is for what purpose perhaps, and what are the therefore intended outcomes based on the level of risk someone may be willing to take. And so that forms our key sort of engagement, so to call it, with each one of our clients. And of course, it's continuous. It's not static. So what we might agree, you know, this year may well change in 2-3 years' time as things evolve, their perceptions, their views, intended consequences, or what they want to you know, do next. So it's really an ongoing cycle that we partner up with our clients with on the holistic management of wealth.
And tell me about the responsibility part of that. And particularly, I think, with your both expertise and passion and commitment to questions of climate, how are you increasingly aligning those decisions when you sit down with your clients and give them a menu of options? How do you put the responsibility filter into that equation?
So I think responsible investing is a term that is increasingly used in asset management, wealth management, financial services, but actually it goes back a lot further than that. So Coutts has been around for 326 years, and clearly one of his core principles is sustainability. So what is sustainability? That's, you know, what is Coutts's role as part of a financial institution in society? And therefore, its actions, are they having the intended consequences and acting responsibly? Now, when you come into financial investments, that's investing in the public markets, stock markets, bonds, etc., you know, the filters originally started with, you know, perhaps even 15, 20 years ago, around what was called negative screening. which is what I don't want. So perhaps I don't like companies that are manufacturers of armament, or perhaps that are in mining. And so that negative screening was the first, I suppose, iteration at scale of how you start to impact investment outcomes. Second then came along, because that evolved, and that said, well, that's a bit binary, just to exclude some, but not others. And then, you know, which one do you exclude, both from a sector, but also geography? The second big change was what's called ESG, environmental, social, and governance issues. And so under the auspices of various regulatory bodies, but also the United Nations, they came up with what's called principles of responsible investing. And these were principles that the countries, all the member countries signed up to, and then the SDG goals to say, okay, which of those elements do we now want to sign up to? And that we will then both measure from a data perspective, but also then have real tangible outcomes to it. So our journey in Coutts began really, you know, a lot earlier than I would expect many other firms did, because of our history, our heritage, but also the nature of our clients, and the increasing way that they were looking at, you know, what consequences that their wealth has. So we signed up to the UN principles of investing, you know, 3 years ago. We then also had ourselves rated to it. And then we said, actually, it's not just about the principles. It's also about how we actually make investment decisions end to end, as opposed to it's just one narrow lens or one particular area or one particular sector or one particular geography. And so responsible investing to me, it should be intrinsic part of how we invest. Because clearly, by definition, you want to be a responsible investor. But then how do you manifest it and how do you measure it? And that becomes both an art and a science. So we said, actually, our investment decision-making process and how we assess investments and how we then allocate that capital, at every step of that journey, we should take into account, is it acting responsibly? And is it conforming to those principles that we have signed up to around both, around three, the environment and the social and the governance issues? And so we take all of those into account and before we invest, and then we invest, and then, of course, we then continuously monitor that.
So you have said that inaction is not an option when it comes to climate change. And what role do you think the financial industry has in helping to accelerate genuine social impact to benefit the planet's health?
So I think the financial industry is a very crucial part of society as a whole. So it's intrinsic. You know, it's where capital from a free market perspective gets allocated most efficiently. And therefore, you have a sense of responsibility around how that's allocated and what's the best way to allocate it responsibly as well, from both a shareholder perspective, but also your wider stakeholders. So it's not just about the shareholder returns. It is also about your wider stakeholders, be they your employees, be they your suppliers, and of course, be they your clients, because that is your ecosystem. It's not just about shareholders solely. They are an important constituent element of what you need to look at, but you also need to look at the wider stakeholder piece. So what do financial services firms do in general, and what do we do in particular? You know, we want to influence change. We want to make sure that it's not a binary decision, that you basically just turn off the capital where you think that they are not conforming to the principles, or they are not conforming to the code that we have all signed up to, be it the climate Paris Agreement, you know, be it social, or be it, you know, governance issues. But until you make people aware, i.e. firms that we invest with, you engage with them, which is the crucial bit, which is engagement, then they'll be none necessarily wiser, and they won't change. And of course, you want them to change. The question really arises that when you put this in place, the framework is there, and you start to measure it, and you engage with firms that we invest with, that they then subsequently don't do anything, then that's the moment when you have to make a decision that, okay, I've tried, we've tried, the industry's tried, but something's just not happening. So that's a moment of truth, which is, okay, now what do I do with my capital? And so we have found that through engagement, you know, there's a process and there's a transition between where you start from and where you want to end up. And that process sometimes, you know, can get accelerated. And sometimes it's just tough because industries are very complex and firms are very complex. And of course, you've got a global investment universe and global supply chain. So you may well be, you know, doing absolutely the right thing in UK, but your supply chain, some other part of the world may not be. But that doesn't mean that you then take your investment away. You say, okay, how can we help them? You know, they may be a long way away. And that's part of, you know, the ecosystem, because if you think of it from a planet, you know, we all want. And if anything that we have learned from a COVID-19 crisis is that these things don't have boundaries. They don't see, you know, whether you're in the West or the East, the North or the South, whether you're rich or poor, they're boundaryless. And so climate is one of those. And so acting responsibly, you know, around climate and making sure that you put the measures in place that then create that impact for change, absolutely, I feel, is not just welcome, but I would encourage every financial institution to be involved.
So we clearly are at an inflection point where at a public and at a policy level, we're seeing growing interest in climate and sustainability as being important. We're seeing governments and politicians allocate money to this area. I mean, if you look at France, Macron, 150 randomly chosen French citizens in a climate assembly come up with 150 recommendations. He adopts 146 of them and allocates 15 billion euros to it. Joe Biden, you know, Democratic presidential candidate, comes out with a $2 trillion green transition set of policy proposals. So it's clearly something in the zeitgeist. And as you sit and as a kind of experienced person who's been looking at it, where do you think the growth areas are for responsible investment? Where are the areas where you think in the next 5, 10, 15 years, capital can seek not just returns, but also impact?
Great question. So I think that's something that we as allocators of capital debate all the time. And it moves. And the reason why some of these decisions move is because technology changes very rapidly, or some exogenous factor, you know, comes in that intervenes, a bit like COVID-19. No one expected it, but it's happened. So where do we see some of these growth areas coming from? So clearly technology is one, which is, you know, technology is your friend. You can measure a lot faster. You can compute a lot faster. And you can bring to bear data that you simply did not have before. So the use of what I call expert systems, you know, other people call it artificial intelligence. So, you know, the more we learn, the more the expert systems learn. And so it becomes a virtuous circle of what needs to be true to have that impact. So we are very positive on a couple of, you know, three sectors. So technology in the broader sense, but specifically in artificial intelligence, in life sciences, new ways of dealing with the environment. So the technology that will come into play, whether it's, you know, moving away from carbon intensive industries, you know, clearly they will have to have a transition. Clearly that will be driven by technology. All of that innovation is a huge, huge area of investment, but also of growth. Because I think without the innovation combined with technology, combined with artificial intelligence, expert systems, I don't think the world can move as rapidly or as fast. So very positive along those. And similarly, I think also life sciences and COVID-19, if anything, has you know, brought this to highlight. I don't think there's ever been a case when the world collectively has looked at a disease or a virus with this much effort and this much research all at the same time. And what's driving it? Innovation. What's driving it? New ways of doing research. collaborative ways of doing research. And what do I mean by collaboration? That's not that, you know, we in the UK don't collaborate with, you know, perhaps our continental European friends or for that matter, Japanese. It's the fact that you've got interdisciplinary research taking place that has never taken place. And so that's a hugely exciting area. And we explore that all the time. So I'm fortunate enough to have been involved with the Francis Crick Institute, which is Europe's largest interdisciplinary research lab, really, for biomedical science. And what do? They bring scientists from all backgrounds. You don't have to be a cancer specialist, but you could be a physicist. You could be a chemical engineer. You could be a computer scientist. You could be a mathematician. But what you have in common is different ways of thinking. What you have in common is innovation. And what you have in common is trying to solve the most complex problems, but through a different lens. And you bring that ecosystem together under one roof, great things will happen. And so I'm very positive that I think there's lots of opportunities and lots of gaps. It's just, you know, unpeeling them, unraveling them and saying, okay, where do we, both short-term, medium-term, and long-term, try and fill those gaps?
So Coutts is really putting its money where its mouth is. You've committed to a 25% reduction in carbon intensity on the equity parts of discretionary portfolios by 2021. So firstly, tell us what's the rationale behind that decision? And secondly, how are you actually implementing and measuring the execution thereof?
Sure, thank you. So what I can tell you, I'm very pleased that when we set the target, which was sometime last year, we have pretty much hit that target now. So we are a little bit ahead of where we wanted to be in timelines, which is fantastic. You know, so well done to the teams that have delivered it. Our longer-term target is 50% reduction in carbon intensity. Now, the question is, you know, how do we achieve that and how do we accelerate this? The way we invest is through two areas. One is finding the best fund managers from around the world and allocating to them because we feel that they're best placed to take advantage of the opportunities wherever they might be, all the way from Japan, all the way to the US, and within those different sectors. So it might be technology, it might be financial services, it might be manufacturing, healthcare, etc. So that's one area. And there our ability to influence rests with my team, our collective influencing power with those managers, fund managers. The second area that we invest in is through what are called passive securities, exchange-traded funds, so index trackers. So I want exposure to the UK broad equity market, the FTSE 100, or the S&P 500 in the US, or whatever it might be, the Nikkei in Japan. So these are passive investments. But across the entire chain, we want to make sure that they, whichever index we invest in through a provider or a fund manager that we invest through, that we have our ESG credentials not only bedded in, but measured, and then we assess each one of these investments on its merit on ESG scoring. So we score before we invest each one of these investments. And where we think the score is low, we then go into an engagement, which is show us your policies as to how you're going to get there and what's that path and how do you measure it and how do you account for it. So our carbon intensity is very much driven by, you know, what are our portfolio companies doing? Our portfolio, both active as well as what's called passive. And what's the transition path that they're on? Because we can't influence it directly from I invest in a particular company versus, you know, A on the stock market versus B on another stock market, but through fund managers, which is why the targets that we've imposed are the targets that we've set also to our third-party fund managers. So we are in tandem with them as opposed to in competition with them. And that's why I think the transition, it takes a little bit longer than what we would like. But what we do know is everyone's on that journey with us. And what we do know is that they absolutely want to address this. And certainly all the investments that we have made through our capital.
ask you a kind of macro, but also a contextual question. In the context of COVID-19, there's been an initial burst of research, which has indicated that ESG funds that impact investing as a field has performed as well as the market, if not better, in response to this once-in-a-century economic, social, political cataclysm that we're going through. And so do you think that that is a blip brought about by Corona, or is there an underlying thesis which is now being shown to be true, that you don't have to trade off returns or compromise returns by investing responsibly?
That's a great question, Paul, because I think there is a lot of perception that if I invest what used to be called in the old days, ethical investing, which then became impact investing, which then became different guises of ESG, that I as an investor would somehow compromise my returns. The overwhelming data and current as well as back-tested data, as well as when you could actually start to invest, actually corroborates the other way. That if you had invested many years ago into ESG compliant funds, securities, etc., that you would be no worse than the ones which are more traditional investments, and in many cases you would be actually better in terms of returns. And so there's both academic studies and real studies. So my view is that I think you don't compromise on returns at all, and if anything, you enhance them. But that's the pure return lens. And the other lens is, it's the right thing to do. So if you're not doing this, then are you putting society in harm's way? And surely that can't be the right outcome either, irrespective of what you think the returns might be. But the empirical evidence all points to that you do not have any detrimental impact on your returns. And certainly we, through our portfolios, have demonstrated that through the crisis, we have performed in our top quartile against all our peers and continue to do so through this. And not all of our peers have the screens that we do. Some do, some don't. But overall, we are right up there, despite the fact that we've been embedding this for a good two and a half years.
So the last couple of years have seen a really intense mobilization around the needs and interests both of women and of people of color. We've seen, the ascendancy both of kind of the Me Too movement and the Black Lives Matter movement. And it's a well-recorded fact that women and people of color have less access to investment and to funding. In fact, a recent report has found that less than 1% of venture capital funding goes to Black men, and that less than 0.006% of venture capital investment goes to Black women. This can't correlate with talent. It has to be about something else. So, what do you think can be done to correct this investment gap?
You raised something really, really close to home for us as a group, and also something that we are absolutely committed to try and fill that gap, bridge the gap as much as we can. Why do I say that? So last year, our group chief executive, Alison Rose, in conjunction with the UK Treasury, UK government, conducted a review on the gap, which was identified, but more importantly, on the impediments that female entrepreneurs face when it comes to raising early stage equity capital. And it was stark. So there was anecdotal evidence before, but this actually brought to home with data why we do not have enough female entrepreneurs in the UK. And a subset of that clearly is also people of ethnic minorities. And so that's called the Rose Review. It was published last year. And as a consequence of that review, a series of actions has now started to take place and implement. One of those is a code of, ethics that we have committed all the big banks who have signed up to it, most of the private equity firms, a lot of the venture capital firms, et cetera, in the UK marketplace, to say that they are committed to address this and they're committed to fill this big gap. Because clearly from a societal perspective, you know, on averages, that's 50% of the population that you have simply not enabled to be able to thrive and therefore succeed. And that cannot be the right, you know, the right outcome. So what we did as a group was instituted a council for female entrepreneurs in conjunction with the UK government, UK Treasury. And that council meets every quarter to try and say, okay, you know, what are the different gaps and how do we try and fill them collectively? Because it's not just about, you know, one institution, it's everyone involved in it. And so Alison chairs that. Under that, there is a sub-council, which I co-chair. And we have committed as a bank now, not only, you know, do we stand behind it, but also try and fill that gap by launching a fund in conjunction with a third party to provide equity capital for female-backed businesses. Of course, in many cases, the first thing is, have you got the data? So how many are there? You know, why don't they get funded? What are the impediments? What are the issues that they face, et cetera, et cetera? And so that report really highlights this, and I'd encourage all the listeners to have a look at it. It's in the public domain. It's called the Rose Review for Female Entrepreneurs. And so we are going, you know, as fast as we possibly can to try and address that. And what we are also wanting is for other financial institutions and the rest of the ecosystem to get involved. And it might be other banks, it might be accountancy firms, it might be law firms, et cetera, et cetera. Because it's a societal thing, as you quite rightly said. And, you know, it is so extreme that I think whatever number you come up with, you just almost think, no, this can't be right because it's just too low. And the number that you quoted is just one of those, which is only 1% of the VC funding goes to black men. And then less than half of 1%, and then half it again, goes to, you know, black women. And so females in general, as, you know, as entrepreneurs, just don't get any access to that funding for a variety of reasons. And so the report is really comprehensive. So I'd encourage everyone to read it because it does highlight a lot of unintentional biases that, you know, people have. And these are unintentional, you know, no one's deliberately biased. And so what you're trying to do is bust some myths for a start through data. And then say, okay, what can I and what can my institution do in its own way to try and bridge that? Because clearly it's in the best interest for everyone.
Well, we've come to the end of our time, and I will say by way of concluding observations, this is a very dislocating moment in human history, and there are plenty of grounds to be concerned and anxious and pessimistic. But I must say that listening to you today chart out a positive solutions-oriented approach to the core challenges of our time, to addressing the climate crisis, to ensuring that there is greater gender equity, to closing the racial funding gap, and to try and place a venerable institution like Coutts with a storied over 300-year history at the forefront of trying to do that is a cause for both encouragement and optimism. So I'm grateful to you and to the institution for seeking to play this role.
Paul, it's been a real privilege. Thank you very much for this. And I would also echo your sentiments. Remain optimistic, but remain curious, because I think we underestimate human innovation and ingenuity. It's not just all about, you know, computers taking over. You know, it is about all of us, and it is all of us working together for a better future. And that's one of the biggest learnings I hope that we'll get embedded post this crisis, and we will come out of this crisis, which is we all want a better future for future generations. So, Paul, thank you again for this platform.
Thank you for listening to Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. For more information on Coutts and their recommendations for a sustainable lifestyle, please visit coutts.com/conduit conversations. And for more information on The Conduit and our community of change makers, please visit theconduit.com.